Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. In the 20th century, a new movement from the Far East captured the Western mind. Since then, the intersection of Christianity and martial arts has generated both conflict and harmony. In between, there remains many gray areas. In my new book, Jesus in the Dojo, I combine timeless theology with modern catechesis to provide a clearer path of reconciliation between the Christian faith and the practice of martial arts. You can find my book, Jesus in the Dojo, available now at most booksellers.
Life is a quest for logic and reason. It is a quest to find balance between science and faith. Life is a quest for knowledge and understanding. But most importantly, it's a quest for personal discovery. Whatever your quest, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. Welcome to Quest. Hi, Electra. Welcome to the Quest podcast.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to have you on the podcast. I've been asking you for years to come on. You finally said yes.
Yes. Well, I finally have something to say.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to come to that message, you know.
I've had your twin sister on several times, and it's always fun to have her. I usually have to put a little message about vulgarity and strong language in your sister's podcast interviews because of the content we usually get into.
It will be the same for me, I'm most likely.
Oh, that's funny. But I am really happy to have you on. You know, we've been friends for a long time. And certainly I've always wanted to get you on here. I know secretly you were just waiting for my podcast ratings to get a little better. So here we are at season six.
And no, we're good. That's it. Was it really season six?
It is. It's season six. Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations.
So, I've been doing these. I'll actually hit episode 100 in this season. So
wow.
I'm almost there. And then maybe take a little break before I do more. We'll see. I don't know how many more. I might have bigger things to talk about after episode 100.
I'd love to talk about you guiding me on my journey with my podcast. So we'll talk about that.
Hoping that you get yours going here in the new year.
Yeah, I've had some ideas. I'd love for you to help me with that. So
great, love to. Well, you know, for those that have listened to past episodes, you may have heard the interviews with Electra's sister Elise, and you know she's kind of given her backstory on how she came to America. But for new listeners or people just wanting to hear your story, your side of this, Electra, talk about kind of your journey to America, because you're not originally from here. You weren't born in the U.S. So let's talk about kind of your early childhood, what young Electra was like, and what happened to get you to the U.S.
Yeah, well, you know, I was born and raised for 16 years in Venezuela, and Venezuela is probably one of, if not the most beautiful place. If you ever can go, I hope we can go together. I would love to show it to you. Loved growing up there, very strong culture, and I, at 16, you know, we had been 6 years enduring the beginning of what turned to be one of the worst dictatorships in South America, and in the history of South America, is a dictatorship led by Chavez. And the collapse, the economic collapse, the political collapse, the socioeconomic collapse was so detrimental to a possible future that my mother decided that she had to send us here to the U.S. And my father, luckily, had lived here for 25 years. He was an American citizen. And so when we got here at 16, very quickly, my father knew, you know, it was that he had to, you know, propel us into the one thing he knew we could do. And we had done all our lives in Venezuela, which was entertainment, because my mother was an actress over there. So,
yeah, we
came here and got on that runway.
You were 16 when you got here. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about your family. Do you have a big family? Did you grow up spiritual and religious? What was that like?
You know, we definitely grew up religious, not because of my family, but because of the school systems. My mom worked very hard to put us in private schools all along our entire childhood.
Are you
So,
Catholic?
Catholic, yeah.
Yeah.
All the schools in Venezuela, all the private schools are mainly Catholic. At least it was back then. And you know, we were taught all the principles of Christianity and Catholicism. And then at home, though, my mom was more spiritual. She was very open. She was bringing in a lot of the Buddhist and Taoist. And then I met my dad, my biological father, at 9 years old, and he was a Taoist at the time. And he, throughout the journey of raising us until we moved in with him, and even after that, he taught us a lot of things about all kinds of religions. So religion has definitely been a part of my life, but it hasn't been like one religion. However, I've always felt this connection to it. It's like, it, not to one specifically, but the structure of religion, I understand it. And I see these patterns in it. And I see the goodness that it provides, you know, and the importance of having a connection to a source. And I understand it as such, as that essential part of our existence.
For sure. How many
Yeah.
brothers and sisters do you have?
Oh, big family. I do have a small family, but big, distant family.
Gotcha.
But I have brothers and sisters. I have my twin sister, Elise, my middle sibling, Isa. She's non-binary. She lives in San Francisco. And my brother, Alejandro, and he's 6 years younger than me. So Isa is 3 years younger, and then Alejandro is 6 years younger. And he lives all over. He travels all over the world. He's a DJ.
Ah, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. I've seen this myself because, I've known you and your sister for a while now. How similar and different are you two? How
Elise
would
and
you,
I.
yeah.
Yeah. You know, we used to be, everyone always assumed that I was the crazy one, is what they would tell me growing up. Elise, growing up, she had you know, some physical conditions, like, you know, autoimmune stuff that she was dealing with early on. I did too, but hers were stronger. And it's sort of what led us to where we are today. But she was just a little more quiet, more, you know, recluse growing up. And I was just this like force, sort of out there, very loud and colorful. And she was always stronger, though. Like, she always could climb faster, run faster, punch harder, you know, whatever it was, you know, she had more strength. And so, but relationship wise, yeah, I was always this loud, you know, bossy. Bossy is like my label. Everyone says I'm bossy. And she says I used to, like, if we were playing any games, I was the mom, she was the daughter. I was the boss, she was the secretary. I was the dog owner, she was the dog. So ridiculous. And then as we grew up, she really stepped into her alpha space. And but even now, even today, I think she has a more balanced nervous system than me. She had to really learn to do that, regulate herself. And I'm now learning. I've learned as a much older adult, just really understanding what I need to be in balance. She's just much more calm naturally than I am.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you moved to the US, you moved to Texas, is that right? Was that your first state?
Yes, we moved to Dallas. We went to Plano West, was our school. The first one was, forgot the name of the first one. Oh my God, that's terrible. But Plano West was the high school we ended up at, and we're there 2 years, and then we moved to Austin, and that was a shocker. Austin was just wild to me. Yeah, loved it. Texas is amazing. If you've never been to Texas, for those listening, it's a vortex of so much culture and good people, good, just lots of fun. It's lots of fun.
I've driven through Texas so many times. I've wanted to live in Austin, like do like a 6 month or 1 year run
You
to take in the
should.
culture there. But I haven't
You
yet. We'll
should.
see. Maybe in the future,
Yeah.
near future, possibly. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I've driven through Texas a lot. I remember one time I used to drive across the country. When I lived in California, I would drive back to Indiana across the country. I love the drive, and especially in my 20s. I could do that drive. I could do that in 34 hours. But I drove every route that there was across the country. And one of my favorites was driving through Texas. And I remember one time I was coming through, I guess I was on the western part of Texas, and it was still warm and it was beautiful. And by the time I got to the eastern part of Texas, it was snowing sideways, a blizzard, on an interstate that was about to be shut down, trying to make my way into like Arkansas, where it was at least going to turn into rain. It was the weirdest trip in terms of the environment and every weather condition. And you get to see like every kind of geography going across Texas. There's every kind of land you can imagine of every color that there is, you know?
Yeah, I know.
It's really the amazing. Desert.
Yeah, you see the hills, the hill country. Yeah,
they farm. There's everything. You know, there's rock formations. It's flat. It's just.
And if you head, you know, south, you see that it's very jungly. It's very much, you know, it's close to Mexico. So you do get that feeling of the jungle there.
There's so much of Texas I haven't seen. I need to really take in that experience at some point.
We'll give you the tour.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, one of my, you know, dark tourism sites I need to go to, and also to support my Cult Following podcast, a little plug there for the Cult Following podcast, is to go to Waco. I got to go to Waco and see it and see what's left there and what it's like in that community, because that was such an important story in America.
Oh, huge. Yeah.
Your first experience with film work was in Austin, right?
Yes. My very, very, I mean, you know, film, as a professional, just like big movie. Yeah. It was in Austin. I had a wonderful opportunity, that I think, you know, I still to this day, it kind of comes back to what I know to be true about the mind, Todd. And, you know, to tell you that story, I want to sort of tell you how I even got the opportunity to get that movie. May I tell you that?
Yeah, I want to hear it.
Yeah. So, you know, my whole life, I've sort of had this, what I've thought was an ability, where I believe I'm seeing the future. And a lot of people have said I'm clairvoyant, and it's not something that I used to be excited about. And then as I've become a professional and have gotten neuroscientists to look at my brain and, you know, really understand what may be going on, which no one can really understand. We still don't understand what even savant means, you know, in the terms of savant and clairaudience, clairvoyance, like clairs at all. We don't get them. But some people, some neuroscientists, friends of mine that I've met along the last couple of years have described my ability to be just the perception of time being nonlinear. And that it could have happened at the time of birth when my twin sister Elise died. And my brain was in such a delicate space of formation. And I may have extrapolated to survive. I may have needed to perceive time outside of the womb or let go. And so to make a choice, my brain out of survival pushed that time perception. And I perceived me experiencing life with Elise, not sure entirely how long after the belly, but I do remember the choice of staying because I knew she would survive. And so she very much survived, that they revived her after we were taken out of my mother's belly. And really interestingly, after that, my mom claims that it was just our whole childhood. I would be like, watch out, or this is going to happen, or, you know, our aunt is coming. It's like, what do you mean? What aunt? It's knock on the door. Aunt is there. So it's just like things like that. Well, as an adult, I've had, you know, friends call me and be like, what's going to happen in this interview? Or what, you know, what do you see with my boyfriend? Is he cheating on me? You know, this has just been my whole life. Sure. And I just assumed that most people perceived like I did growing up. And then obviously as I became an adult, I realized, no, that's not very normal. So I became interested in understanding the mind. But at 19, not 16, but at 19, I had met Robert Rodriguez. He was married to my aunt. He's a very famous filmmaker. He had done Sin City while I was in Dallas. And the movie was a huge success. And that's what really put him on the map universally. I think just everybody heard his name after that movie. And I remember what that did for my family. I remember just on my father's side, you know, everybody really excited. And had become this huge movement in my family. And my father got to work behind the scenes with him in several projects, one of which was Sin City. He was the Foley editor and the behind the scenes director. And one day I walked in, I had jobs. I was doing commercials in Austin and doing classes. And, you know, I had always been an actress since I was born in Venezuela. So I wanted to pursue that. And when I found out Robert was his director, I was like, I'm going to work with him. I want to work with him. I love him. He's so awesome. He's so fun. Every time we're in his house, he's just showing us the movies he's doing. He was just such a, just a kid, you know, so much fun being around him. And it was a dream to work with him. And I just had this like strong desire to work with him. It was so strong. I can't describe it. And that I saw this script called Grindhouse sitting on my father's table. And I was like, what is that? And he's like, it's your uncle's next movie. And I just was like, oh, okay. I don't read it or anything. I just step out and I go to my job. And I was a host at a restaurant that time. And the hostess asked me like, oh, what are you up to these days? So I was like, oh, I just got hired to be in this movie. I just got cast, this Grindhouse. And I just lie about it. And man, 2 days later, my dad called me and I was in college at school. And he said, your uncle wants you to audition for this film. And I was like, wow. And, you know, to this day, this is how I develop what I'm doing now, which we'll get to. But it's really been that understanding that, am I seeing it or am I willing it? Am I calling it in? But yeah, that's how I got the opportunity to even audition for him. And Elise came with me to that audition just to accompany me. And we got into an argument in front of Robert. She was like, don't do it like this. I'm like, fuck you, bitch, you interrupt me. And we just got into it. And yeah.
So much I want to unpack with this conversation.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's fine. So first off, I didn't know that twins role wasn't written for twins. So I thought always it was, I thought the two of you entered the business together as twins. So this is all new to me, how this went down. And I will just tell everyone a little bit, you know, so the Crazy Babysitter twins were, you know, they were the thing in his Planet Terror movie. Also in Quentin Tarantino's film that he did, that was also one of the Grindhouses.
Death Proof.
You were in that. And then the Crazy Babysitter twins went on to be in other stuff too, like the Machete movies. I think several of those sequels, maybe even. Did you do two of those or three of those? I can't remember how many you did.
I think we did two. I think we did two sequels.
So you were in pop culture fandom from that point on, for sure, from those roles. And I want to talk for a minute about these movies because I really, really enjoyed these movies. Now, I knew of Robert all the way, like further back with El Mariachi and things like that, because I was waiting for this change in cinema for a long time.
Yeah.
And just to kind of tell everyone a little bit about how these directors came to be, was in the 80s in Hollywood, we had what was called sequelitis, where everything had a sequel and a number. You know, it was Rocky 3, Rocky 4, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, 4, 5, 6, Friday the 13th, Part 7. You know, it was like that's what it was. Everything was numbered. It was all these sequels. It was crazy. If you think the MCU is weird and convoluted today with what they do at Marvel, you should have seen the 80s.
Yeah.
And you know, that can only go on for so long until the bubble bursts. And I think we're seeing that bubble burst today with the MCU. People are just tired of superhero movies. It's like, come on, man. Like, really, this is all there is? That's what ushers in this era of independent film. So you had Spike Lee, who was one of the first ones, Richard Linklater. Certainly, you know, Robert Rodriguez with El Mariachi, Quentin Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs, you know, Kevin Smith, Clerks, you know, another one. So a lot of these directors started to get discovered through film festivals or just being known for making movies on their credit cards. Like, I think El Mariachi was like $8,000 and, you know,
$7,000.
Yeah. Like, he did everything on it. He shot it, directed it, wrote it, edited it. He did every job.
He submitted himself for a clinical trial that paid him $7,000, and he used the money to make the movie.
And Kevin Smith used his credit cards, maxed out all his credit cards. There were directors who would go rent a video camera at like a Best Buy and use it for 30 days and return it. It was like any way that they could come up with it. And then these movies were actually really good. And it sort of ushered in a new era of cinema. And then kind of sequelitis was gone overnight, you know, literally, because now people were wanting to see these really interesting movies. You know, we'll mention the Weinstein Company here. You know, Miramax was, you know, pretty much single-handedly responsible for turning the tide of this, you know?
Yeah. And those brothers, you know, they say what you want about them. They were amazing. I mean, they, you know, they're true passionate filmmakers and passionate, you know, about real film that, you know, obviously we know what has been said about them, but I think that what really drove them to build what they built was that passion for filmmaking.
They would shop around all these films at different film festivals all over, and they would pick them up and they would put them out in these wide releases. And it was just, it was really a new era of cinema. It made a new breed of actress, a new breed of actor. These films had cult followings, as we've seen from Quentin's. It seemed every movie he made was better than the last one. You know, it was really pretty incredible to see how it went. And you got to be, you know, in that with those people in that day, which is really exciting. And I want to steer back into this in a moment, but I want to just take a little side trip with you when you mentioned seeing the future, because this really spurs like its own little route of discussion, because I think it's fascinating. I've often thought about this, whether manifesting is the thing or seeing the future is the thing, you know, what is it? Like, you could have manifested this job by just going out and being positive. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be an actress in this film. Some people will call that manifesting, right? Some people are just on the right path, the right road, because maybe they kind of know what the future is. Or is it the same thing? What do you think? Are these different things, Electra, or are they the same thing or what?
I just love you for asking me that question, because that is the center core of what I am building, which is the understanding that we have superpowers, if we want to call it that way. All of us, every single person has the ability to tap into our subconscious and make a bridge between the conscious and the subconscious. You know, all of us have these ideas, these goals, these dreams, something we want to build, something we want to experience or do. And then we're like, well, why not? Why doesn't it happen for me? Well, it specifically relates. If you look at the principles of neuroplasticity, you know that we already have proof, scientific proof, that we can change our mind. And that there are principles. One of them is repetition. So there are, you know, in my belief, and it's what I'm teaching people right now, is manifestation, wishful thinking, calling something, it's all the same thing. And being on the right path, it has to be aligned between mind and heart. And many will also say spirit. And when I believe spirit is, whether you believe in spirit or not, it's attached, it's when we feel this surge of energy that we call passion. It's like enormous energy that we know is driving us forward. We don't know what exactly it is. You know, we don't choose it. It doesn't seem to be something we choose. It seems to be something that is driving us, that wakes us up, that keeps us up at night, that, you know, calls us outside of everything else that seems to be important. That is the most important. And we don't know why that exists within us. And we all have that one calling in us that we often don't listen to. So if we can find that and let that pilot light drive forward, we can use that energy to connect to a very specific vision of what we want. At that time, for me, was acting. And it was with Robert, and I wanted to be in that movie. And what I believe I did is I gave my mind a directive that is so strong, that it had no chance to not focus on the directive. That what it does is it trumps the emotional signaling from an old trauma that tells you, well, what if you don't get it? What if people don't see your genius? You know, what if they give it to someone else? The passion that I had was so strong that it trumped it.
What would you say? Oh, good.
No, tell me.
What would you say to a person that would say nepotism got you in the business?
And nepotism did. Nepotism gave me the opportunity. Absolutely it did. He wouldn't even have known that I was in the in the math. However, I had already done auditioned for all the casting directors that cast for his films in Austin. And they knew about me. They did not know I was related to him because we didn't have the same last name or anything. Right. Like, it was just, so they knew who I was, but so could I have had the opportunity to audition for him? Yes. Directly with him, because I bypassed the casting director. I mean, she was in the room, but I didn't have to do that, you know, the first audition. I went straight to the studio. In fact, it was probably my 10th time going to Troublemaker Studio. So I knew the studio really well. So yeah, nepotism for sure did it. And I was really grateful for it.
Nepotism is a weird thing to talk about in the entertainment industry, because some people, I'm really a fan of generational families in the business.
Yeah.
I love it. I love seeing 3 and 4 and 5 generations of acting families. I think it's an awesome thing to see that, you know, if it's in the blood, you know.
It's in the blood, and it's also in resources. The reality of the survival of the fittest and resources. Mm-hmm. You're going to give the role to your closest person, right? Your family. You're going to keep it in the family.
And I don't believe that at that time with, you know, Robert Starr on the rise, because I believe Spy Kids had been out at that point. Sin City was out before Planet Terror, right? Wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Sin City happened like 3 years before, I think.
Mm-hmm. And Desperado had been out, I believe, before that. So, mm-hmm. So he was already definitely well on the rise.
I really don't think
that he would have put someone who wasn't qualified to be in that movie. You know?
Oh, no. I mean, the casting process was quite thorough. And in fact, mm-hmm. he auditioned a bunch of women for that role. And, you know, I think it's interesting because, and I don't know if he would actually tell you this, but he wrote the role with my lines, because when I arrived, the entire script were lines that I had said to him at a gathering in his house a few months prior. And I was kind of shocked. You know, he had me read. I was like, oh, this is a story about my college experience. And he was like, it's so funny. Your brain was burning, like everything you said. Like, I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I was like, all right. So I had already inspired him to write that role. So I think that for whatever reason, he thought it would be funny to have that. And then I think it is possible that he thought of Elise and I being in the role together. But I remember clearly that was not a decision made until that argument happened. You know, they were like, he was like, I love this. This is what I want. And, you know, so it's like, I think in the end, it ended up being sort of a little bit of magic and relationship that I had built with him for years of going to his house since I was 16 and him finding me funny, you know?
Mm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm trying to remember who you had scenes with. You were in a scene with Marley Shelton, right? Is that where you...
Marley.
You had your scene with Marley, and then
Rebel was his son.
Yeah, his son. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's who you're babysitting. Yeah, who's like a full grown man now.
Yeah, you know, so strange.
Yeah, Robert posted some pictures of his kids, and I was like, they're all like adults.
Yeah, they're all adults, and they were so used to the kids. Yeah.
And then the both of you show up in Death Proof in Quentin's show. I'm assuming it's the same characters. Maybe this is the same world. I'm not really sure.
Well, you know, Death Proof is supposed to be, if you catch it, I'm gonna dare you to watch it again. If you catch it, you will see that they are in Planet Terror. They talk about Death Proof. They're listening to the radio and a few scenes, and you're catching like what they talked about in Death Proof. So Death Proof is supposed to be happening right before Planet Terror. So it's almost a prequel to Planet Terror.
Yeah, I thought that it was. and in that scene, you know, Quentin's in that. He plays the bartender. Kurt Russell is in that. Kind of a rogues gallery of female actresses that would become super huge after that.
Well, and you know, the scenes that we did for Planet Terror, I mean, we went with everyone. I don't know if you remember, we continue along in the convoy.
Right, you do.
The survivals. Yeah, so we end up, like, we had Bruce Willis, there's like so
Jeff
many
Fahey,
different scenes.
All those people were there.
Yeah, yeah, all the way through the end.
Freddie Rodriguez, Rose McGowan, all those people. I still think that's Freddie's best role he's ever done.
I agree. I agree. He was great.
They really made him for such a, like a short man. They really made him into like a really big, like an action star in that. I really feel like it's Quentin and Robert had a great way of making people cool in their movies.
Yes.
And I think people really like to get in those. What are your memories of being on this on set with all those great people?
I just, I loved everyone. I felt a great connection with many of the actors. I think that, I remember I remember meeting Bruce, I thought he was my dad. Like I wish I could show you a picture of my dad. He looks so much like Bruce Willis. He did very much back then. And so I was like, my dad was on set, he was in behind the scenes. That's not another part of the nepotism of this whole story. So my dad was around. So he was around with his camera. Weirdly, both of them had a pink shirt that day. So it really confused people. And I turned around and I was like, Papi, Papi. And he walked up to me and he put his hands next to me. And I had no idea that Bruce Willis was in the movie at this point. And he put his hands on my cheeks. We're in the makeup trailer. And he's looking at me through the mirror. He goes, I'm not your papi. And I was like, I was just like, what the fuck? And just like lost my shit. And, same thing happened with Fergie. She introduces herself as Stacy. I don't know this is Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah.
She doesn't look like her at all. Just like without the makeup and stuff, she had a ponytail. Like, I'm just like, oh, this is another actress, Stacy. So then they do her up and I turn left. I'm like, that's fucking Fergie sitting next to me. And it's just the whole thing. The whole movie was like that. Freddie was, he really took me under his wing. He taught me a lot. He was a very cool person, very, very cool, very religious. And at the time, we used to pray with Marley, pray for the set, pray for the crew, pray for Robert and Elizabeth, my aunt, they were going through so much. It was because they went through the divorce during that shoot, but the whole, the whole experience was amazing. And even McGowan, Rose McGowan was, a lovely, lovely person to work with. She was always very, very kind.
Mm.
Yeah.
I love this. Those are like one of my guilty pleasures, watching those movies. And the reason why is I think, that movie underperformed at the box office. Mm-hmm. That was what I feel some of the best work of those directors, but the Weinsteins didn't know how to market it. And I think it was even beyond the marketing. And this has been 20 years ago. This movie came out 20 years ago at this point. But, I grew up with drive-in cinema. I grew up with drive-in cinema and the grindhouses. And the difference is, if you lived in the Midwest or the Southeast, you got drive-ins because there was space. But if you lived in a big city, there was no space for a drive-in. So you had grindhouse cinemas, which were traditionally kind of old burlesque cinemas, stages from the 30s. It might have been live performances. They might have shown, films early on, and they were usually dilapidated, and they would show the grindhouses, much like the drive-ins, would show double features, triple features, usually themed. It might have been blaxploitation cinema, or it might have been martial arts films, sexploitation. Yeah. It was any number of films, and you wouldn't watch those. And that's what those guys grew up with, those directors grew up with, and they wanted to make their own versions. And to me, they did it spot on. I mean, they couldn't have been any more perfect. Like, you would swear you were watching a movie from those periods. Robert's more like 80s horror films, like the John Carpenter stuff was the inspiration for those. And then Quentin's more like 70s drive-in cinema, which was a lot of car racing movies and things like that, which is what that was. So I love them. They were perfect for me. Still some of my favorite movies to watch. But the audience didn't get it. So there wasn't, wasn't their best films, to this day, but it has a cult following, which is really amazing. And,
it was a sad reality. I remember that weekend. I remember being so confused because here the movie comes out and I remember we were sitting in Los Angeles. We had moved to LA a few weeks before. Or a month before. And I remember sitting at the time at the house of one of the director of marketing of the Weinstein Company. She was awesome, Sandra. And we were sitting there and we're just sitting there. She's looking at the numbers online on her phone or something. And she goes, this is a fucking tank. And I was like, what does that mean? And she's like, it's a fucking tank. And she just starts crying. And she's like, she calls my aunt. She calls Robert. She puts him on speakerphone. She's like, it's a fucking tank, guys. We tanked it. And she's just losing it. And I'm like, what does that mean? And, an hour later, she sits us and she's like, girls, this movie's going away. I'm like, what? Like, this huge, we had done the premiere. It was such a big deal. We couldn't believe it. But then, you know, what's interesting is immediately after that, we are contacted by Bill Philpott and Sean Clark. They were partners at the time, and they ran circuits all over all the Comic Cons and, you know, all the conventions all over the world. And we are put on a one track convention route all over the world. And it is hundreds of thousands of people. And it's like, we meet so many people all over the world, crazy fans. And we're just like, what's the disconnect? We don't understand. Yeah. Like the cult happened quick, you know, it just did not translate.
It's fascinating because the typical movie going audience is like the 16 to 24 year old. That's what they are. You know, that's who you get. If it's not parents taking their kids to see like a little Disney animated film, it's 16 to 24. After 24, you're in your adult life. You're seldom going out for date night to the movies. So there's a narrow window anyways. And this was pre-COVID. You know, this was the window. And it's been the window for a long time. But what was weird about it was, if you were a product of the 70s, like me, you were out of going to the cinema, even if Tarantino was making something that was inspiring of the movies you grew up with. And even if you looked at the younger audience, most of them still weren't really born or aware of what 80s movies were. So even Roberts was very dated for the type of film it was, which was an 80s inspired type of film. So that was really the problem with it. It was out of the gate. While it was being made, I think someone somewhere might have had the foresight to think, you know, this is going to be lost on our audience. They're not going to understand the film burning. They're not going to understand the artifacts of film. They're not going to understand flipping acts around or cutting segments out or inserting. Like, they're not going to get what went on at a drive-in cinema when the film would break and they'd have to piece it together. Like, no one's going to get that.
Yeah,
and that was the problem.
And I think expecting it to be a big blockbuster is really the problem. It's not supposed to be that. Would that have been, you know, like, it was supposed to be a cult.
Yeah.
And those were the people who went to see it afterwards. And that was okay.
It did make its money back. It didn't make them all the money they wanted, but it made its money back. And it didn't hurt anyone in the movie or the directors because they kept going with their careers.
Yeah. Oh, and it's still making us money. I mean, I still get grindhouse checks and, you know, it hasn't stopped.
Well, here's what I love. As we're recording this on the first day of December, right now in the theaters is a film based on part of the grindhouse movies. So Eli Roth has his Thanksgiving movie out, which was one of the faux trailers
from
the grindhouse films. Yeah. And it's a huge hit. In fact, it actually outperformed the Marvels for Disney, and they've already greenlit Thanksgiving 2. So
I had no idea. So, this is so exciting.
So for those that are lost on what I'm talking about here, as part of this grindhouse cinema experience, when you went to the movie theater to see this double feature, you were invested in this 3-hour cinema experience of these two movies, Planet Terror and Death Proof. And before the movies, they would run faux trailers for movies that didn't exist, all done by famous filmmakers. So Edgar Wright, he did one called...
Edgar did No. Don't.
Don't. He did Don't. It was called Don't. And it was basically all done like a British horror film, which was great. And Rob Zombie did Werewolf Women of the SS or something like that, I think he did. Hobo with a Shotgun was one of them, which was made into a film early on with Rutger Hauer. That was the first one that was made. And then Machete, which became its own movies, right?
Was there another? And then there was, of course, Thanksgiving.
And there was Thanksgiving, yeah. And now Thanksgiving has been made into its own film. Eli's done that. And it's a huge hit. And you got to go see it. Because although he pulls back a little on how grindhousey it was with the old film, it's definitely pays an homage to it, and people loved it.
Oh, that's so great. I need to reach out to him.
He announced yesterday, he got on his Instagram, and he said that they've officially said he can do a second one, and it won't come out until 2025. But John Carver will carve again. So
I'm so proud of him. That's so great. Yeah. I have a funny story with Eli. I didn't know he was... There were a group of extras, actors that were extras, that were locals in Austin, and I knew them, and they were just really cool girls. We just always hung out, and when I got to the set, I was like, oh my God. So we ended up hanging out, and we were in my trailer, and they're actually very successful women in different industries now. But we were all having lunch together, and they invite this guy who I think is another extra. It's Eli. And he's on the table with us, and we start talking about horror movies and like what we like, what we don't like. And then someone was like, starts talking about Hostel. And I'm like, ew, that movie is so fucked up. Like, it just brings me all kinds of feelings. Like, I just hate it so much. It's just like, I can't believe that someone would make such a horrible movie. And Eli goes, what do you mean? Like, what don't you like about it? And I'm like, I just feel like whoever is making films like this is a fucking psychopath.
Which is the greatest compliment for him, probably.
I know. He looked at me. He was like, "Oh, okay." And he like didn't say anything, and he just like kept walking. And then one of my girls that was there, she looked at me. She was like, "You know, that's the director of Hostel." I was like, "No." Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times this happened to me. I'm such a Martian when it comes to these things, and I just felt like so embarrassed. But we became really close because of that. So then, you know, we were friends after that.
Yeah. You know, I can't watch the Hostel movies. The torture porn's too much for me.
It's too much.
What he did after that, though, what was the one he did where the kids go out to the cabin out in the woods that, you know?
Oh, Cabin Fever.
Cabin Fever. I love Cabin Fever.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. But I actually worked with, so I have a couple of experiences with Eli. I had a small role in The House with the Clock in Its Walls that he directed.
Which, really?
Yeah. So that was really cool to shoot that in Georgia.
Yeah.
And I'm just in the big scene where they have the eclipse. So it's all I'm in, as I'm out there and I'm a parent and I don't have any rides.
I haven't seen that movie.
And because it was his way to move into kind of like, they wanted to make like their own Harry Potter. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also like a weird book series. And they, you know, there's witchcraft and, you know, there's evil stuff and it's kind of creepy.
His wife was there, right? The Chilean actress. Yeah.
Yeah. He was married to her at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was there. So that was really neat to work on that. He was under a lot of, it wasn't his deal, you know, like the movie didn't do well, even with Jack Black and like the cast that they had.
It was pretty large.
Was great, but it underperformed. It didn't do well. I think the book was too old. Maybe the kids didn't get it. The studio didn't quite get the Harry Potter thing they wanted to make out of it, you know? Mm. And you could tell he was so stressed on set. Like he was really under the gun. A lot of people on him where he has more freedom with his own films. I don't hardly ever talk about entertainment about my entertainment journey in this podcast because I try to keep it spiritual and religious and, you know, help people get where they're at.
Why you became who you are and why you are in the spiritual path that you are is because you went through this, you know, we went through this journey similarly where we went through so much heartbreak and saw so many lost people in that industry. And yeah, I think that it's 100% part of what we built. And the passion for storytelling and filmmaking is also part of what drove us to do what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
for sure. Yeah. In general, I always feel like the entertainment business is a toxic, awful business. But but there's a caveat to it. It's terrible. Yeah. It chews people up and spits them out. It's an engine that never ends. And there's a million people that have been expendable in it. And the biggest star in the business will eventually one day be an outcast in the business. It's always been that way. It doesn't matter who you were. The biggest star in the world will eventually be forgotten and overlooked. And there's always some level of bitterness or jadedness. But the money of this engine keeps it rolling along, chewing up and spitting out people as they go.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because particularly when it comes to you know, actors and actresses in this business, if you're... And it's a terrible dynamic, really, I think, maybe skewed a little bit more toward men than women in the business. If you're a male actor and you get bald or you get fat, you're no longer wanted in the business. I don't know if you remember that time when Christian Slater put on a little weight and got bald. Nobody wanted him in a movie. And he got some hair plugs, got back in shape. He's back in the business, right? You're like, you see that, right? If you get fat or you get bald and you're a man, you're out. But
unless you've always been the fat, bald guy.
Unless you're the fattest, funny guy, you know, which is, that's what I call it, the fattest, funny guy, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people can work their whole lives. Look at young Kevin Costner, middle-aged Kevin Costner, older Kevin Costner.
He looks the same though.
Man's incredible in all ages. Mel Gibson was the same way. There's that young Mel Gibson that you got in Mad Max, and you had
Mel Gibson
of Lethal Weapon, and the older Mel, and they all look great. And until you become frail, you can really work the whole time. Like Clint Eastwood, don't need to see him anymore. He's like bones now. Like, he's incredibly talented. Probably don't need to see him on screen anymore. It's too much. We saw it with Paul Newman, Robert Redford's that way right now, until they get frail, right? Women, though, it's a much different thing. When you start to hit 30, if you're on the wrong side of 30, it gets very difficult to work. And I want you to think for a minute about actors like a Michelle Pfeiffer or a Susan Sarandon or Sharon Stone, the top of their game. Very few, if there were 100 actresses you were competing with in your 30s, 10 of them made it to be working actresses in their 40s. And about 3 of those made it to be working actors in their 50s. And about 1 or 2 of those made it to be working actors in their 60s. It's crazy. So Susan Sarandon still looks great for her age, still out there doing her thing, you know, but not a lot of actors. Many, many, many fell to the wayside.
Yeah.
So that's the terrible part of the toxic part of this business, and how it kind of just chews people up and spits them out. And some people just never get a chance to make it in those careers.
It's a biological impulse that's driving all of us anyway. And I think that as long as if you have charisma and you have, you know, talent and you're stunning,
you have great people to handle you.
And you have nepotism, then you have all the kids. To be honest, when I was acting, I never felt like a good actress, ever have. And I still don't think I'm a great actress. I think I can deliver a line and I can emote because of my past and my childhood. I have a great ability to connect with those emotions and the tumultuous past I had. But I don't, you know, great acting is, it requires a passion for connecting with someone's story that I don't think I had as a performer. I was more interested in the story itself than I was around the performance. And so that's why I was so interested in the production part, producing and, you know, sort of handling the behind the scenes and why I moved into that space more and more over the years.
And when I was talking about kind of, you know, this toxic business of entertainment that chews people up and spits them out, I included that little but, because I also think what Hollywood provides is a good and decent public service. And what that public service is, and why I do admire entertainment and I admire entertainers, is that people, I write about this in my first Metatomics book, people have terrible lives, right? Like people live in ordinary misery. So they plug into their 9-to-5 job. That's what they do every day, 9-to-5. They live paycheck to paycheck. They get 2 weeks of vacation a year. In that 2 weeks of vacation, everyone always goes to the same place. You go to Myrtle Beach. You go to Disney World. It's the same place, the Smoky Mountains, you know, get a chalet in Gatlinburg. Like, it's always the same places you hear common people go to. This is how they're plugged in the matrix. They have a mortgage for 30 years. They have car payments. They have insurance. They have fuel, gas, problems with their wives, problems with their kids, credit card debt, college they're paying for 30 years. They're completely plugged in a system, plugged in a matrix. And the only thing that keeps people sane is entertainment. So they can forget about their problems by listening to Taylor Swift for an hour. They can watch their favorite TV show. They'll put that Grindhouse DVD in and watch it. You know, they'll watch something mindless like a Fast and the Furious movie, which is what I do. That's what I have to do. I think all day long. I just want to not think at night. So I put on a Transformers movie or, you know, something with explosions and boobs, you know, like that's what, you know, that's what I need. Hey, that's unwind,
that's
right? Like, I just have to not think about anything. It's got to be pretty people and explosions and cars. Like, that's what I need to you know, forget about everything over the day, right? So, so I think a lot of people, that's what they have to do, right? They go to a bar, they drink, they listen to their favorite music. Maybe they go to a casino, maybe, you know, whatever it is they do, music, movies, read a book, play video games. That's how they stay sane. So they can get up the next day and do it again. That's what most people in the world, 99% of this country, that's what they do. Worker bees that plug in the matrix. And it doesn't matter whether you work at Burger King or you're a doctor. It's just a sliding scale of where the ordinary misery is. Maybe this guy has an apartment. This guy has a home in a gated community. Everyone still has the same level of debt and things associated and tagged to them. There's not a lot of people that really truly have the freedom to escape that. So entertainment is there and performers are there to entertain the public. So in that regard, I think it's a good and decent public service.
Well, you know, and what you're saying, I think it's a survival mechanism. And so we need it. It is very much like theater was for peasants back in the day, you know, back in, you know, kingdom times. Theater was a very big part of entertainment. And is that thing, right? It's getting lost and there are a fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And I think we need it. We all need it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because people can forget about their problems over the course of that 2-hour movie. You know?
Well, you know, in 2008, the entertainment industry just, it was amazing. It skyrocketed. Like the movies did so well. I raised $4 million in 2008 during the crash. Literally houses all around me in my neighborhood in LA were foreclosed and went foreclosure. And I'm raising millions. And I'm just like, how the fuck? And that and alcohol, it all went up during the crash. So, you know, we see this constantly. And during 2020 was the biggest increase in all streaming services that the entertainment industry just expanded in every way.
You and I might disagree on this next thing here, but I felt how the strike went this year was terrible on the consumer. I feel like what SAG did, you know, I get what they're wanting, right? But I also understand how companies run. And companies want to appeal to their shareholders because they're supposed to make them money. They're not supposed to make the actor in the project richer. They're supposed to make their shareholders money. That's what they're supposed to do. And they're supposed to deliver good content to the consumer. So the consumer wants to buy stuff that then makes the shareholders richer. But the unions want to change how all that works. But the union's tactics this year was really devious, in my opinion. And I felt like, you know, the Halloween costume ban, don't dress like your favorite characters, don't dress like fandom, don't, you know, and also, you know, telling the consumer not to go consume entertainment. People are in a bad state. And this is what you want to do. This is how you want to, like, it's demeaning to the consumer that wants to take in a movie that an actress is in. And the union is holding them hostage so you can pay more money. Because what they're going to do is if they get the money from the studios, guess who's going to wind up paying more? The consumer. It was bad all the way around for the consumer. And the fans make you, you know?
And believe it or not, actors actually really heard from this. And there was a big conversation, very hush-hush, between a lot of actors. We held conversations, conference calls, Zoom calls, just talking about this behind the scenes and how it felt like very much like a mafia move.
You know from conventions, right? How many of those pictures of the crazy babysitter twins did you sign? I was at a convention over the summer where a friend of mine's daughter couldn't get a signed picture of a Harry Potter actress from the movie. She could only get her head shot. What the fuck? Really? You're going to go to a pop culture convention, but the union has told you you're not allowed to sell anything that supports the movie you were in. So all those actors all summer long, they did all the conventions because they needed to make money because they weren't working, couldn't sign a picture of themselves in Star Trek. They couldn't sign a picture of themselves in Harry Potter or in a Marvel movie. They had to sign black and white headshots. Are you kidding me? Like, how much more do you want to slap the fans in the face because the union is greedy?
And again, remember, the union's making a massive percentage. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really make that big of a difference for the actor. I mean, ideally, you know, we have more support financially, but the truth is actors are really well paid. Really, really well paid. And that's the one thing I realized once I stepped out of the acting world, you know, nobody else is getting paid like actors.
You know, $4,700 a week or whatever it is, the SAG minimum. I can't remember what it is now. And I can't help but think to myself, a fireman doesn't make that in a week. A teacher who spends all day with your kids doesn't make that. The garbage man doesn't make that. Like, it's incredible.
I was making $5,000 a day.
Yeah. It's incredible the arrogance of the union and of actors to make that much money, because I always felt like, hey, if you want to, in my mind, you know, the battling Todd, I was thinking of all these devious things the studios could have done to really battle the union if they wanted to, if they really wanted to break the union. And what they should have done is sent the teachers' unions out there to picket across the street. You know, where are my wages? You know, and look, it's not my fault that you're in an industry where you might only work one day. And because you only work one day, you need to make so much more money. You know, chose this profession where you might only work one day or one week. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to make $4,000, right?
Yeah, it's a complex, you know, to be honest, I don't even know entirely how it was resolved. I read just sort of I skimmed the summary, and it felt, just the whole process and just talking to the actors, it felt like a mafia move. And everybody just, and I remember some of the biggest actors that I worked with in the last 5 years before I walked out, we all got on a call. Some are massive, and I mean, A-lists. And they were saying how much this is hurting everybody, including them, and how they were not agreeing with what SAG was doing. But at that, it's the same thing with many other topics, which we're not going to talk about today. In the last 3-4 years, you get canceled if you speak up. So a lot of actors just took it. They just let it roll.
And to be fair, I think, you know, all this stuff, I think the whole residuals thing is absurd anyways. And I think that
it's
trying
amazing
to pull,
for us.
Pull, well, here's what I'm just going to say though, right? Like, I've gotten 7 cents from The Walking Dead as a residual, and I've gotten $85 from The Walking Dead for a residual, you know? And so it's absurd, and it's all over the place, and there's no real way to track it. I think it's crazy. It's stupid. It's absurd. I think trying to pull money from streaming is absurd. I think this is what they should do. I think you just say, this is what an actor needs to make. I don't care if they say it's $10,000 a day. Just let's have one rate and you walk on and you do it and it's over. You don't keep getting repaid 8 cents for every time something plays. It's ridiculous. Just make the rate for where they show up, they do the work, here's your money, go away. And be done with it.
it's interesting because I was thinking about that the other day. It's just like when you look at corporate videos and anything like that, you don't get paid when, like, actors or whoever gets filmed in something for a teaching course or whatever, you're not making anything out of that. You get paid, but that's it. You know, so you get paid one time. So this whole thing with residuals, you know, I don't know. I obviously, as an actress, like, it's been so fucking great to get mailbox money for the last 20 years.
Of course, yeah.
And I still do. I still make money from all the TV shows and everything. And it's not a lot of money, but it's great. And it's great just to get it every once in a while, you know.
I agree with that.
But at the same time, it's like, I do understand, you know, it's like, we're done.
I don't.
There should at least be like a window where it's like.
Well, I don't call the plumber to fix my toilet and then pay him money every time I flush the toilet. You know, it's like, look, you got paid for the job. The job is done. Like, you walked on set, you delivered your lines for X amount of time. It's over. Go home now, get another job. Like, that's that to me, that's fair. The whole idea of, oh, I'm going to keep taking a little more. It's robbery. You know, it's just like, it's crazy. It's like, let's keep asking for some more money. We just, let's raise the pay up front. So it's, we're just clear and transparent.
True. And like, I was paid really fucking well for everything. I never got underpaid ever. I mean, definitely. I mean, maybe I did in respect to other actors. Like, I was just really grateful for everything I always got. It was the most money I had ever seen, you know, more money than any other job I'd ever done. So I was just happy and always grateful. But, you know, that is, I think, it's a matter of opinion for sure. You know, I don't know. I feel like when I finish a job, like, I'm not the same actress from Grindhouse. I don't, you know, I'm not living that life. It is kind of strange that I still get those residuals, you know, I'm grateful for them, but it's strange. I don't even, I'm not even in that industry anymore.
Yeah.
And you know what is really freaking weird? I'm not going to tell you how much I have in my pension at SAG because I don't want to get into details about that. But let's just say it's a lot of fucking money that they have taken out of my paycheck to build into this pension. And when I got out of the industry, got out of SAG, they basically said, unless you're a SAG member, you cannot, and unless you continue to work, you cannot take advantage of this pension at all. And I'm like, so all this money that is sitting in this pension that you took, is that can't even transfer it to any type of, you know, IRA or whatever, nothing. It just sits there.
Yeah.
And it's very weird to me. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah. There's a, unions have traditionally, and not just that one, but most unions have had traditionally underhanded tactics through the years. I get their purpose. I do, but I just, I have this real love-hate relationship with guilds, especially in entertainment, and how just the greed is just what undermines it all. But this time in particular, aside from the greed element, was just how the fans were treated. Because when I saw the at those conventions, and I thought, wow, all these actors are here because of greed. They got to pay their mortgage, but they can't even sell a picture of them in the franchise film they were in. Like, this is nuts. I've never seen anything like this. Who wants to buy your freaking headshot? You know?
I definitely did not live through that, obviously, because I was not in it anymore. But I can't imagine having gone to a convention and just like all of that and then not allowed to take advantage.
They did allow, you were allowed to bring stuff in and they could sign it. But if you wanted to buy something off the table, there was nothing, you know, just literally their black and white headshots was what they were signing. And it's just, it's crazy. You just saw so many disappointed parents and upset children that really wanted to get a picture of their favorite person from their favorite movie and they couldn't do it. And I thought, man, that is dirty. Like stuff you shot years ago that you should still be allowed to promote.
And the actors just had to respect it because of the SAG. Mm-hmm. The union was, why did they have union members in every convention?
Well, I mean, most of those actors, I mean, even William Shatner is still in the union, you know, like, but he couldn't sign anything from Star Trek. So that was the mandate. And that came down from the union. They told all their actors, we're not gonna, this will stick it to the studios, you know, like.
You know what's worse? It's not just the actors that are hurt, and the actors are, they get really good money and they can live off of it. It's like, I can't tell you, I have so many friends in the industry who are crew members who have not worked for months, are just now getting calls. Yeah. It was like 6 months of no work and they were really struggling.
Well, you know, that contract isn't ratified yet. They're still looking at the AI because Justine Bateman's out there like telling everyone, this is a bad deal. Don't do it. Personally, I'm all for the AI. I'm all for it. I remember when I was in Godzilla, they did this whole scan of me and they're like, we need your permission. You know, Sony's going to do this scan. You know, we're going to, and I'm like, what's it for? And they're like, well, cause we can put you in anything. Like we can set you on fire safely. We can, you know, digitally put you in, you know, the top of the oil rig walking around and stuff, you know, like this is what we can do. And we just need you digitally and we're going to own it forever. And we can put you in any of the, you know, any of the offshoot Godzillas, anything we want, bring you back. And I'm like, yes, like, this is great. I'll get to be in them all. So I was all for it. I was like, yes. And of course, in Godzilla, King of Monsters, you see me walking around on the top of the little, the little oil rig. And of course, you know, you see me in the undersea base. You see me, you know, for real in places, but you also see me, you know, getting destroyed and getting set on fire. And I'm like, this is awesome. And then me put in digitally in other films. And I'm like, I didn't even have to be there and I'm in it. I didn't make money on it, but I'm still in it, you know? And, so I'm kind of for the AI thing. I think it's pretty cool, but it's going to hurt so many of the lower tier actors. It's going to cripple them. And Justine's right that they need to take a hard look at it and read it and say, don't sign this.
Yeah. I mean, AI, man, I'm now, you know, part of what I do is I'm a coach in biotech, and a lot of biotech venture capitalists and founders and innovators and scientists. And so that world, I'm learning a lot about AI. And one thing that I realized is it's moving faster than we could even comprehend. I mean, we don't really have a grasp on it. We think we do, but, you know, talking to the greatest people out there, you know, if you have a conversation with Sam Altman, like, he's very aware of the complications, you know?
I'm a huge fan. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of AI. I have an AI version of my voice. I have AI version of Todd, younger and older. I could die tomorrow and keep my metatomic stuff going on for the next 100 years.
So, that's amazing.
If L. Ron Hubbard were alive, he would probably be a huge fan of AI.
Yeah, definitely.
But in entertainment, I see. But, you know, that's been going that way for a long time. I've often thought that if the technology evolved enough, it would be great to see, you know, an AI version of a James Dean come back and see another James Dean movie. Or, you know,
it would be great.
If I were an actor like a George Clooney, I would be the first person to want to say, yes, replicate younger version of me and put me in movies out there again as the virile, you know, hunky leading man. Like, that's what I would want to do. Yeah. I would be like, yes.
They just want to make sure that they get paid.
Yeah.
You know,
just take my Kevin Costner likeness of me from Bull Durham and make more movies with me of that age. It's fine. Yes. Because fans would a lot of fans would love that again to see that. I think there's elements of this that we've never even tapped into.
Yeah. And, you know, then there's also the delicacy of using the likeness of someone and then creating a narrative that is not real around a very important topic, you know, like an actor having an opinion about something and it's not really that actor, you know, that's the delicate part of AI that I think everybody's really scared of. And if we don't have clear boundaries and regulations, I think that we are headed in the wrong direction.
For sure. You know, I think we've gotten into some interesting topics about the entertainment industry and the seedy sides of it and the politics of it. And you know, I really wanted to touch on the grindhouse part of your career, because that's my favorite part. But you moved to LA and you worked on a bunch of other things. And you had a successful career both in front of and behind the camera. And we don't, you know, people can find that stuff on their own on the Internet Movie Database. And there's not really much I want to dig into there. But there's certainly, this business is kind of ugly and it's seedy and I think it ultimately got you thinking about wanting to return to Texas. Will you talk about kind of that time when you made that decision, when it was time for you to leave LA and go back to Texas again?
Yeah, well, you know, it's, and I can tell you, you know, I'm going to tell you without names.
Sure.
So there was a specific person that I worked with in several films. And he was a producer. And, you know, I found out many years later. I remember I was probably 26 years old. I went to a premiere and I was walking the red carpet. I remember seeing him just sort of at the edge of the red carpet, and people were calling his name. And he saw me and they called my name. So he could tell I was there, and he said hi and I said hi. And I had not seen him for a while. And, you know, we went and watched the film. We walked out. I walked out and I see, in fact, Eli was there actually. So it was one of the last times I saw Eli and in person. And he told me, this producer, he asked me, he was like, "You didn't get this particular film, did you?" And I was like, "I didn't. How do you know about that?" And he was like, I don't know. How do I know about that? You keep saying no to me. So as soon as you say yes, you will get what you want. And he was so clearly telling me that he had been holding the keys of a lot of the doors that I've been knocking on for so long. And that's when I realized that, you know, it felt futile. You know, I felt so, so sick. And I had been very sick because of, like, physically sick. I had been ill for a year, for like first time I had ever gone through this in my life. Anxiety. I started bleeding, like, internally, throwing up blood. I was doing all kinds of things that were making me very sick, but none of it was drugs. It was basically just diet. It was a very stressful life. I had never done cocaine. Never done anything really heavy. I had like smoked weed and done a couple mushrooms. And so it was very weird for the doctors at the time to be like, why are you so sick? Interestingly though, they all prescribed me a whole cocktail of drugs that were even stronger than cocaine that started destroying the lining of my stomach after I started getting sick. They diagnosed me with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, none of which were actually true in the end, thankfully. But it was that event with that producer on that red carpet that I knew I had to leave. And just to backtrack, like, this is someone I met when I was very young. I was 21 years old. It was just moved to LA. And I was at the Four Seasons Hotel, and he came on to me very strongly. And then it just happened that throughout the years, as I bumped into him, and he would seek me out. You know, I would be in Europe and he was there, and you know, any event, any major event, major film premiere or film festival, he was there. And somehow he was at the hotel I was at, and it was just like this predatory behavior. And I became so ill and had this desire to just end life or end that life, you know, just like, get me out of here. So I walked out of that premiere and I called my family and I said, I need a break. I really need a break. So I left. I came to Austin, and it was like my healing journey began that moment, the moment I came to Austin.
Yeah, for sure. I think if the audience is smart enough, they might be able to guess this person.
Not going to we'll say names.
But we're not naming names in this podcast. So
no.
You know, I think that does that, you know, Southern California, LA, that Hollywood thing, it does send you back home. You know, it's done it for me. It's done it for all kinds of people. That industry just, it figures out a way. It's like it wants to, it's like it's its own entity, and it tries to seek out your vulnerabilities.
It's amazing for the people who are still there, the women who are still there, women who I've spoken with, who were very jaded, a lot of actresses that were very jaded and were very hurt and were just spent from all the abuse, and actors too, male actors. But they endured, they're there, you know, their passion trumps all of that trauma, you know, and they moved on, and they found ways to heal and to forgive and to evolve. And I think that's a really beautiful part of the human psyche, the human heart, the human spirit, is that how resilient we are and how we're rushing to health. We're rushing to survive all the time. We're rushing to heal, you know?
What was your transition into the wellness industry after you got back to Texas? What was that like? Because I know, you know, when we eventually, and I keep drawing a blank on how far back we know each other, but it's been a long time. And I think we might've started talking at the end of your time in California, but definitely at the beginning of your time back in Texas.
Yeah, but you know, it's so weird because when did we meet?
I don't remember
either. And you know what's weird? We went to Indiana a lot, Kentucky, and for a lot of those conventions. And I always thought, did I meet him there? It's so weird.
We definitely met at a convention, but I remember like our first like real heart to heart talks were probably in like 2017, 2016.
Yeah, I was already here. Yeah, because I remember we had kept in touch on social media and stuff, and We would text about, you know, the things we're passionate about. And you were always so encouraging to me, Todd. And I, you know, I remember, are you going to get that call?
No, we're going to mute that. Okay. Go ahead, tell your story.
You know, I remember just, okay, so to answer your question about the wellness, I was very sick. I landed in Austin. I told my dad, like, I need a break and I have very little amount of savings from the acting industry and I need to do something to survive. And I remember at the time, I was negotiating a contract with BlackBerry. They reached out to Elise and I to do this thing called Two Scoops. And we found out Robert was directing it and he didn't even know that BlackBerry had reached out to us. So they reached out to him and then reached out to us separately. And then Robert called me and was like, are you guys casting this? And we're like, yeah. And he's like, oh, shit. So then we met up and we all wrote the script together. It was really fun. It was just a commercial. BlackBerry, it was like their last hurrah, trying so hard to survive. And they obviously folded. But it was a great little contract I made. I remember, I think I made $30,000 on that. And that helped me for a bit for the rest of the year when I landed here in Austin. And my dad was like, I am opening or had opened a cheese company. I need a co-founder. I need someone to come in and take this on with me. And I was like, okay, I know business, let's go. So we started building this structure of this business and we really hit it. I mean, we went everywhere and it's a raw cheese company. He still owns the company and I'm a co-owner. Actually, my siblings, all of us, we all co-own this with him. And we really went everywhere. We expanded all over Texas. And then Zoe Saldana learned about what we were doing a few years later. And that journey and Zoe wanting to feature us in her network is called, I forgot her network, Bese. It was called Bese. It's a Latin network featuring Latin makers. And so she featured us in one of the docuseries. And we just sort of blew up. The company blew up, Dos Lunas Cheese. And it's been really a great journey. And in that journey, I learned about the microbiome and the connection between the microbiome and the mind, the gut and mind connection. And there's a book about it. And I learned so much about how nutrition is medicine or poison and how I had been poisoning myself for years in LA. And lots of Taco Bell, lots of chalupas, lots of weed and Taco Bell. Many nights with Colton Haynes, eating a lot of fast food. We were roommates and we just had too much fun. And, you know, I was destroying the lining of my stomach and the stress and the millions I owed people and all the stuff that I was doing as a filmmaker, as a producer. It was too much. So then I decided to just really dive into that. And so I started, you know, bringing in my know-how of advertising and media and worked with other companies and continue with those Lunas. And then I landed at Alive and Well. When I started to want to heal my body, I was going through a process of alopecia, which is an autoimmune response of hair loss.
Yeah.
And Alive and Well at the time was a hill country spa. And in 2020, this visionary man, Michael Swale, and his wife, Elizabeth Swale, bought it from the original owner, who was a visionary himself, Adam Metcalf. And Michael Swale and Elizabeth Swale basically decided, we're turning this into a functional medicine clinic. We're taking it to the next level. And so they brought in every single famous, well-known, established functional medicine practitioner. And it was the labor of a lot of focus, love, and I learned so much about functional health and how to really connect the dots between, you know, the gut, the mind, the subconscious, the trauma, nutrition, and how it develops into disease or not, how longevity really happens. So at some point in that journey, I asked Michael that I wanted to, you know, expand in the concept and create other, like a summit for Alive and Well. And I had this network idea and like really educate people. And he was like, we're growing sustainably. Like we can't expand that fast. And I was like, okay, I got to jump. I got to do this. I have an idea. So then I jumped and I left my job, which is one of the best jobs I've ever had. I loved working there. I loved working with the people that trained me, Shannon Cohen, the director of operations. She taught me everything I need to know about mindset mastery. I mean, she is a fucking amazing coach, and she was the seed for the MR method and the company that I founded. She taught me the principles of mindset mastery, and now I'm doing that. That was my journey to wellness.
I want to talk about the MR method in a moment, but I want to go backtrack just for a second. I don't believe that Colton Haynes' chiseled body had Taco Bell in it.
You're not going to believe it. That guy, I swear to God, that guy, he's going to hate me for this, but he was born perfect.
Yeah. He's like a statue, chiseled out statue.
He was so, I mean, I'll tell you, I know he came out to everybody, and I had to keep a secret for so long, but I didn't know when we met him.
His beard for a while?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is a thing in Hollywood, people.
Yeah, I was a fruit fly. I walked into a restaurant. I kind of forgot the name of the restaurant, but I walked in with Elise, and I got so obsessed with him. I was like, the moment I met him, I was like, you look like Edward Cullen. And he's like, who? No, he's like, is that a vampire? I was like, yeah. He's like, I've heard this before. I was like, it's a book. Oh my God, they're making a movie about it. And that night I asked him to come over to a house that was across the street from the restaurant he worked at. And he's like, going to do what? And we're like, we just want you to come over. Just come over. So Elise and I waited for him outside of the restaurant. And he came out and he's like, okay, I'll go with you guys. So he trusted. He was 18. He was 18. We're 21. So totally crater robbing. We're obsessed with this gorgeous kid. Take him into our apartment. And I just tell him, like, I'm obsessed with you. You're so beautiful. And he's like, but you don't even know me. And I was like, I just want to make out with you. And he was like, okay. So we made out for hours. Like, we were all over him. I mean, we were just like, play with his hair and like tickle him all over his body. And literally weeks, he like moved in for weeks. And we became really, really close. And then at the end of the summer, when I had really tried to sleep with him so many times, and he would not budge. He's like, I don't want to ruin the friendship. And I was like, what friendship? Give me your dick. He did not. He did not budge. We would just make out. And then one day he said, I'm gay. And I was like, But the cool thing about that was that I was in love with him. And I realized, okay, well, this doesn't mean it's over. This just means I get to have you forever. So we became best friends, and I moved in to his building, and we lived across from each other for many years. And then I moved away, and then I came back, and we were best friends until the very last moment I left LA. And to this day, we still catch up, and we connect. And
I was a fan of him in the Arrowverse stuff on CW. You know, he was really good in that when he was in that. But yeah. Aside from, you know, his dietary, which I don't believe he was, but I want to know about you. So you're a master cheesemaker. So I have a question about
father.
Well, you got to know the business,
really, but
right?
You can ask me questions.
The recipe, the family recipe's got to go to you, right? You know?
Yeah, I actually, it's interesting. It's I know it now, but for 10 years, my dad would hide the cultures in ice. I mean, he still does that. He does not give anyone, I know the recipe, nobody does. He puts them in ice cubes and and then drops the ice cube, like takes it to the cheese facility and then drops them. Nobody, you can't even reverse engineer it once it's been in ice. So he's just like, my dad protects IP and all that stuff. But,
my question is, how is a cheese like that, or why is it better than, say, these processed cheeses we get in the store? Like, what's the advantage of getting a gourmet cheese like what your dad makes?
Well, and the secret is raw, which means it's unpasteurized. And specifically, to be able to get a product that is unpasteurized in the U.S., milk is illegal. You cannot drink raw milk. You can drink it. You just can't sell it. So we can't be merchants of raw milk. There are raw milk co-ops all over Texas. But the only way you do a co-op is that people own shares of the cows. So you have a cow herd, and people pay into this co-op to own shares of the cows. So they get the milk for free, essentially. And so that's how you bypass I guess, a law around commercializing raw milk. And it's become a very popular thing in America, because in California and Texas, because these old, you know, four or five generation dairy makers realize if we keep the cows in grass and we feed them local grasses and we don't force milk them, people like Bob Strick at Strick Jersey Farm, which is one of the most successful farms in Schulenburg, Texas, they serve hundreds of thousands of people in the Austin and surrounding areas, Metroplex. They focused on grass-fed cows, and they don't force milk them, and they don't, there's no antibiotic treatments, there's no, none of that. And they're A2 milk from A2 cows, and there's Jersey cows, which is the highest level of fat and cream. And that's how that milk, that very high quality milk, where they're never fed anything but grass, survives the process of not being pasteurized. It remains raw. So it has all the enzymes. It's a full enzymic body. So when you consume it, your body is just drinking what we call Proby milk or Proby cheese, you know. The cheese itself, though, because raw milk is illegal to be sold, fresh, obviously. When we made the cheese, the FDA showed up at our door and we were like, you can't sell this. This is fresh, raw cheese. It's illegal. It's going to kill people. And we're like, what? Like, there's the only way that you can do this is if you age it 60 days. And so we started aging at 60 days, and that's why we named the company Dos Lunas, just two moons in Spanish. Yeah.
That's great.
But the cheese, so you know, we have cheese that is 12 years old, 15 years old. Cheese does not, raw cheese can only get better. It does not expire.
Wow.
So
that's incredible. Yeah. I didn't know that. Something I wanted to know more about.
So if you go to the grocery store, you can actually buy raw cheese at Whole Foods and a few great grocery stores. Any cheesemonger, like cheese store, will have raw cheese now. It's a very, you know, very requested item these days because a lot of people are understanding the importance. If you usually eat regular sandwiches with like normal pasteurized cheese, I recommend having a little bit of raw cheese in your diet. So you just, if you have a little bit every week, that raw cheese enzyme will help you break down all the other pasteurized dairy enzymes that you have in your body, because you need that raw cheese to break it down. Otherwise, you're consuming a dead product. Your body does not know what to do with that.
Right.
So
interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Tell the listeners a little bit about the Amar method.
Yeah. So the Amar method is an ever emerging, evolving language of what I'm calling the language of information. So information being something that is in formation constantly. So that is what I'm developing. And it is it's a method that is going to turn into a language at some point where people will learn to listen to themselves at every level of their being. And it begins with bridging the subconscious and the conscious and understanding the principles of how our mind is really listening to what we want, a conscious directive, and really taking it on as a directive and saying, oh, I can support you here. It cannot support you if you don't give it a clear vision, a clear ask. And if that clear ask doesn't have a stronger emotional directive than the fear to fail. Because we have so much drama around our hopes and our dreams, but that is usually what intersects the clear directive to say, like, I really want to get this job. Oh, but remember, you didn't get it last time. Oh, but remember, Mary, when you were in middle school, got that project. So you're not getting this one either. So to trump that, you need a stronger emotional signaling to trump the lizard brain from fighting you and protecting you from getting it. And so there's a subconscious sabotage that shows up when your brain thinks you're going to fail at something. So to trump that, you have to have enormous passion, enormous excitement, like beyond it to trump the directive. And then now the mind is focusing on that. And then the third directive of that is repetition in action. So you have to do it every day. That's why we look at prayer and you see these families. There's a very particular family that I wish I could say their last name, but it's a very, very famous Christian family in the US, and they own Christian camps everywhere, and they are so successful, and they are, everyone in that family is doing so well And I know them personally, and they are healthy and thriving. And at the top of their practice is prayer. They all pray for each other, and they bring so much joy into it. And what I've learned, if you look at prayer and how prayer is a part of people's success, you realize that there is a scientific method attached to that. It's a scientific proof of how the mind is attaching a directive. And so you can say there's a bigger, yes, I believe there's something bigger than us listening and helping us along the way and really listening to our ask. But for the ones who don't believe, we have proved that the mind is listening and that we can bridge and trump the fear from sabotage. So that's what I'm developing. I'm developing a method to teach people how to listen to themselves. And it's been radical to look at the neuroplasticity shift in people. You know, people who come to me, some of my clients will come to me and say, you know, I'm folding my company in the next 3 weeks and I'm not, you know, I'm coming to you to coach me out of it and to not kill myself. And within 3 weeks, we've changed the manifesto of their lives entirely. And we've completely veered a 180 story around what they believed to be true and what they want to experience. And their lives change within 3 weeks. These people are raising $20 million and taking a whole new leap into the life they really want. So it's really about deciding how you want to live your life. And the first thing I teach people with this is radical self-responsibility, and that we are the master designers of our lives. And if you take that on, really, if you're committed to it, you transform your life.
And how do you deliver this content to people? Is this through workshops or retreats, a book?
Yeah, I do. And I'm writing a book. You've been very encouraging about. I do all of it. I do workshops. I do Zoom one-on-one coaching. I'm starting a program in January, which is changing the structure for me a little bit because it essentially is bringing in a medical team, a functional medicine team, partnering with Sadie Kaufman. She has developed a method herself called the Sadie Kaufman method. She is very successful in Mexico. I was actually just talking to a very famous rapper 2 weeks ago, and I told him about next year and Sadie Kaufman. I was just about to tell him. He's like, what? She changed my mom's life. She reversed her cancer. I was like, so, you know, I realized she's a little more known than I thought she was. So I'm feeling a little bit, you know, kind of starstruck with her in the last few days because I didn't realize before how big she was. And now we're in relationship. Now we're doing this thing together, but really excited to partner with her. She's reversing cancer disease. She's been doing it for 10 years. And now we are doing this together. So we're doing a program for us to connect the dots and look at sabotage from a blood level. We can basically locate you on your anatomical, mental, emotional, and we'll talk about spiritual, but the anatomical GPS location of your life and see where you want to go so that we can really trace there and to stop sabotage from the place you're really at. Because I think the problem right now is that everybody gets generalized in their health. And so they don't really know where they're starting from.
Sure. Right. Yeah. That's fascinating. I love it. I can't wait to follow and see where this goes.
Yeah.
Last question I have for you before we wrap this, this interview up, what's your daily health and wellness routine?
Oh my God. Boy. Well, sauna is number one. I can definitely expand on the time that I'm doing that. But for example, this morning I did sauna and cold plunge. Sauna and cold plunge is something I've really taken on. And my husband just bought me a cold plunge because I was like, I don't want to be going to the gym every time. So we're getting a sauna too. So sauna cold plunge is my go-to. I do yoga 3 times a week. Stretching has been a very important thing for me. And one of the most important things that I do is what I call envisioning, which is very much like prayer. And it's connecting with my breath. I do breath work when I do it. And I go very deep and I start envisioning what I really want. And I start giving my mind a directive, not only about that day, that week, that year. You know, I just really go forward. And I want to say it to you now. When I do this, I start getting visions of things that are to come in my life and other people's lives. And I've been seeing for the last few months, these twins, I have twins, And I think I'm going to get pregnant with twins. And I'm not, we're not doing in vitro. We're not doing any of that. So if I have twins, Todd, I said it. I said it.
I'm glad really you said that and not that, Todd, I'm going to see you get hit by a bus.
No.
Don't cross the street on next Tuesday. But yeah. Now that's great. I wondered if you were going to mention meditation and prayer, because, you know, that's obviously the first things I get from people.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Prayer. I pray, and I definitely focus not only on mine, but everyone's success that I love, that I wish for. You know, it's that circle has expanded. You know, but prayer has been a part of my life, my whole life, and the Catholic prayer, and now it's just really wishing for people to make all their dreams come true, to be well, to be healthy, to find health if they're not healthy, and yeah, it's a major part of
for
my life.
Well, Electra, this has been worth the 5-year wait to get you on here. So,
thank you. But you see why?
Let's go ahead and make an appointment for 2027 to bring you back on for a.
Okay, done.
For the next one.
Done.
But how can people find you out there on the internet and social media and stuff like that?
Yes, you can find me on theamarmethod.com. It's my website, so theamarmethod.com. I also have a company I'm developing called DMRSummit.com, and that is all my events and stuff, but it's DMRMethod.com. That's where you can find me and doing speaking events, and really excited to be working with you on that too. Yeah, just expanding in all fronts.
Well, I love it. So everyone go out and check out all the great things that Electra's done and what she has in store for you in the future. And until next time, Electra, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Todd.
And we'll talk soon, okay?
Talk soon.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Cult Following is a podcast that studies the personalities and common traits of cult leaders and their followers. Get the real story behind these infamous and oftentimes tragic cults from a new perspective, through exhaustive research, and from interviews with people that were there. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.